tonight on PBS News Weekend. As jockeys and horses prepare for the 148th Preakness, a look at the state of horse racing and why so many horses die at America's racetracks. Then what you need to know about the growing use of artificial intelligence in medicine, and how three native communities in Louisiana are fighting to save their tribal lands from rising sea levels.
We have outsiders come here and they see the lack and they see the loss. We who belong here, we see what's still here, what's still viable, what still makes life in this region, you know, so precious.
Good evening, I'm John Yang. President Biden is headed into the last day of the G7 summit in Japan while keeping an eye on the potential for economic disaster at home if he can't make a deal with Congress on raising the debt limit. Last night, White House and House Republican negotiators met for more than an hour in the Capitol with no apparent signs of progress. The president's due back at the White House late Sunday from his abbreviated trip. In Japan today, Mr. Biden said he's not worried after Friday's pause and restart of the talks.
And then what happens is the carriers go back to the principals and say, this is what we're thinking about. And then people put down new claims. I still believe we'll be able to avoid a default and we'll get something decent done.
The U.S. Treasury could run out of cash and need to borrow to meet its debts as early as June 1st. That's the day that $47 billion in Medicare benefits are due to be paid. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is also at the G7 summit, gathering support from world leaders ahead of an anticipated counteroffensive to take back Russian-controlled territory. Today, Zelensky met Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi face-to-face for the first time. Modi has so far refused to condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Tomorrow, he's scheduled to meet with President Biden. In Los Angeles last night, WNBA star Brittany Griner played in her first regular season game since she was freed from a Russian prison. Vice President Kamala Harris attended the game and spoke to Griner and her Phoenix Mercury teammates before the opening tip-off.
Thank you for all that you did in supporting Brittany, because I know that was rough and that was so difficult for you. A team is a team, that's family.
The team was greeted with a standing ovation when they took the court. Griner was the top scorer in the Mercury's loss to the Los Angeles Sparks. She ended the night with 18 points, 6 rebounds, and 4 blocks. Still to come on PBS News Weekend, medicine's use of artificial intelligence and native communities fight rising sea levels.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
People will be watching this evening's Preakness Stakes in Baltimore to see if Derby winner Mage wins the second race in the Triple Crown and to see if all 7 horses make it around the 1 mile oval safely. Already, during one of the preliminary races this afternoon, a horse was fatally injured and euthanized at Pimlico. Racehorse deaths at tracks are alarmingly common. Over 10 days leading up to the Kentucky Derby, 7 horses died at Churchill Downs. According to a group that opposes racing as inhumane, so far this year, 136 thoroughbreds have died, and last year, 901. That's more than 2 every day. Beth Harris covers the horse racing industry for the Associated Press. Beth, you've heard the numbers that we cited, and they do come from a group that opposes, wants to see horse racing go away. What would you say to put those into perspective and context?
Well, John, I think you also have to look at some other numbers, and these would be from the equine injury database that the Jockey Club maintains, and they take their numbers and granularize them from various racetracks around the country. And those actually show that per 1,000 starters in 2022, the rate of fatalities declined. And it was the 4th straight year that the rate has declined. So everybody has their different sets of numbers, but that's generally considered the industry standard is the equine injury database.
Are you saying that there is an acceptable level? Or is the industry saying there's an acceptable level of horse deaths?
I think the industry would say the acceptable level is 0, but they also realize and understand that you're never going to get to zero. It's just something that over time you can get as close to zero, but these fatalities have a slew of reasons behind them. And it's just highly unpredictable in terms of, you know, sending horses and jockeys out to race every day, what could happen.
Another thing that critics talk about is the medication and doping of horses. They say it allows, or it's to keep horses competing who may be fragile in health and sort of threatening their health by doing this. What's the industry's response?
Well, the industry has gotten something called HISA, the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Authority. It's going to kick in 2 days after the Preakness in terms of its anti-doping and medication controls. And they are hoping that this will be the so-called central office for the sport of racing in the U.S., much like you have the commissioner's office in baseball, football, hockey, and basketball. This will be a centralized authority that will oversee the pre-race, post-race testing. They plan on doing extensive out-of-competition testing as well. And there will be a set level of standards that will be adhered to. Also, when there is a positive test, there'll be a set procedure, and they plan to notify the parties involved in a quicker fashion than what we typically have seen when it's left up to the individual racing states, which is the way it's been for many, many years now.
That I know that it was congressionally mandated after a high number of deaths at Santa Anita in 2018 and 2019. Has there been any opposition? Is anyone fighting that, either in the industry or in state racing commissions?
Very much so. There's a handful of states, as well as an organization that represents about 30,000 trainers and owners in the U.S. who have filed multiple lawsuits against HISA, claiming that it's violating constitutionality. These groups would rather have the states and state elected racing officials mandate what's going on instead of turning it over to the higher power that that Congress has approved.
You mentioned that there have been clusters of deaths and that there are multiple reasons for horse racing deaths. But when you get clusters like the one we saw at Santa Anita in 2018, 2019, I think 30 horses died during the racing season. You had a cluster of seven in a month at Laurel Park a couple of years ago. This string of seven at Churchill Downs. Is there a commonality through those clusters?
Yeah, some of the injuries occurred during training. Some of them occurred in actual races. Most recently with the deaths at Churchill Downs, it was a variety of situations. Two of them occurred in races on Derby Day. Another occurred when a horse flipped in the paddock. It apparently may have been spooked by something it saw, and it flipped and hurt itself and was not able to be saved. So generally, there are a variety of causes. It could be a catastrophic leg injury. Some horses have dropped dead of heart attacks. Each case can be individual, and there's obviously standards by which they investigate these deaths. They do necropsies to analyze the animal, and much like we would have an autopsy in a human being. So there's a variety of reasons, and I think that's what's most befuddling to the industry and also to fans and the critics, is that there just is no pat answer. There's no easy answer for why this is happening.
Beth Harris of the Associated Press, thank you very much.
Thanks, John.
Artificial intelligence is finding its place in all sorts of scientific fields, and perhaps none holds more life-saving promise than healthcare. Programs are learning to answer patients' medical questions and diagnose illnesses, but there's still some problems to be worked out. Earlier, I spoke with Dr. Isaac Kohane, the editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, AI, and the chair of Harvard's Department of Biomedical Informatics. I asked him about AI's potential in medicine.
Doctors can definitely use AI as an augmentation, so they'll remember or be reminded of all the things that they should know about their patient, their specific patient, and about all other similar patients like them. At the same time, patients are all too aware that in the United States, we don't have enough primary care doctors. And so we have very little time with doctors if we can get any time. And so providing another, if flawed, resource to get them medical advice so they can decide whether or not to actually seek medical advice is also probably going to be transformative. When a doctor sees me, they, I can tell you, they've forgotten a lot of details about me. What if you could actually just have, and it's doable today, a summary that says, what are all the important things that Isaac Kohane has medically that you should know about today? And then saying, what are all the other patients who are like Isaac Kohane? What are the right treatments? Is he on the right treatments? Are there any screening tests that we should do on him today during his visit? Medicine is getting increasingly more complex. There are more things that we know how to do for preventive medicine. But in fact, prevention is getting less and less attention in many, many ways because doctors are so, so busy. These AI programs are not infallible. In fact, they can make mistakes, but at least it's a conversation you can have, and then you can go decide, should I actually discuss this with my doctor?
How far off are these things? How soon before they're realized?
So right now, they are highly imperfect, but they're being used today. And the reason they're being used today is because there is such a great need. We've all heard of the so-called Dr. Google. The fact is that people use search already to obtain medical advice. When ChatGPT was released by OpenAI this past winter, patients started using it already. We know that for a fact. We know that doctors started using it already. People don't realize that 30% of the costs of healthcare are administrative overhead. The billing procedures, getting authorization, deciding whether to do reimbursements, and they involve some judgment, medical judgment about how appropriate the care is, whether a patient should be allowed or not. So that is happening right now today.
You've said a number of times that it's flawed, it's imperfect. What should the patient be looking for? Are there red flags that the patient should be looking for?
Sometimes it can be quite subtle, but I think the obvious ones are it makes a reference to an authoritative source. Check that source. These programs have been known to make up citations. I know that Google and Microsoft are working hard to eliminate those by having independent programs. Second, I would never actually do anything that was at all risky without first checking with a medical authority. So if it told you to change your medication, which it won't, but if it says this medication may not be appropriate, that's useful in the sense that it should allow you to have a conversation. I would not do it. The other thing is that using human common sense turns out to be an incredibly useful filter.
Looking farther down the road, what's the promise of AI? What do developers and doctors and others in healthcare hope that it will be able to do in the future?
So I think that doctors are not spending enough time with patients. They're spending too much time as bureaucrats. Having AI take care of that bureaucracy will allow doctors, we hope, to interface more with patients. That's the short-term hope. The longer-term hope, which is, when I say long-term, I don't mean 20 years. I'm talking about 5 years, is that these programs will actually be able to look at all our data under the right privacy provisions and actually come up with new biomedical insights, new potential treatments, groups of patients who could benefit from these treatments, and actually accelerate the drug discovery process as well. Because in the end, the same limitations that we were talking about human beings as doctors also afflict human beings as life science researchers. They can't know everything. They can't know of all the discoveries that are being made at one time. These programs are pretty good about knowing about everything.
Is that the biggest potential pitfall? People putting too much reliance, too much trust in it?
I think that is absolutely the absolute pitfall. First of all, I would rely on our common sense. I am not convinced, and nor are others, that it has common sense at all times. And even if it did have a kind of common sense, in the end, we have to be true to our values. And I'm pretty sure that at this point, we cannot rely on these programs on sharing our values. But I think the most important thing that these companies could do would be tell us which data were these trained on, these models trained on. We don't know what these models were trained on. But, and that tells me, for example, that I don't know, does it correctly represent the problems that American patients have? Or, you know, did it see a lot of data from India? And so not knowing which data were used to train these models leaves a lot of uncertainty around quality and applicability to different populations.
Dr. Isaac Kahane of the New England Journal of Medicine, AI. Thank you very much.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
In Louisiana, coastal erosion claims an average of a football field of land every hour. Some Native American communities in southeastern Louisiana are the hardest hit. Special correspondent Megan Thompson brings us the story of three indigenous communities fighting to save their land.
My mamafin is buried all the way in the back right-hand corner, who is my grandpa's mom.
At a small cemetery on Louisiana's Gulf Coast, Devin Parfait pays respects to his Native American ancestors. He spent his early years here in Duloc, Louisiana, as part of the Grand Cayo Duloc Band of Biloxi Chitimacha Choctaw. The tribe of nearly 1,100 people has been in the area for centuries, but now Parfait's worried about its future.
One of the biggest problems is that whenever we have storms that come in, the storm surge that it brings will sometimes carry these coffins out, and people will have to go out into the water and grab these coffins and bring them back.
The coffin that was once in this grave has disappeared. Some of the tombstones that remain are deteriorating or turned upside down. But the destruction of this final resting place is just one part of a much bigger problem.
This right here is the lot where I lived up until the second grade.
Parfait's childhood home was destroyed in 2005 by Hurricane Rita.
I think about all that's been lost. I mean, our culture, our heritage, the physical lands. I think about the efforts going on now about coastal restoration and how they don't do enough for these communities who are living on the front lines here.
Parfait is now in a position to help change that.
Great to meet you. How you doing?
Last year, at age 25, he became the chief of his tribe. He also earned a bachelor's degree in geoscience so he could study how much coastal land loss was affecting tribal communities.
My research specifically was answering questions that other scientists didn't come down here to answer.
Parfait found that some tribal communities in this area are losing land at more than double the rate of the rest of coastal Louisiana because, he explains, tribes were pushed out to the farthest reaches of Louisiana's southeastern coast after the U.S. government forced them to relocate in the 1800s.
Even in my lifetime, I've noticed that the shoreline has encroached and moved further inland.
Parfait also has a new job working for the Environmental Defense Fund. He's partnering with other tribal leaders and Louisiana State University to tackle one major cause of erosion: the 27,000 abandoned canals dug over decades by the oil and gas industry that have sliced up the wetlands.
All the bayous are getting wider.
Teresa Dardar and her husband Donald are members of the Pointe aux Chiens tribe based in Montague, 16 miles east of Parfait's tribal home. They're working with Parfait to convince outsiders that tribal land is worth saving.
Whenever we have meetings, I tell them, you know, we're the bumper, but if you don't protect us,
you're next. Yep.
All of this used to be forest where Donald would hunt as a boy. Now they're surrounded by water as far as the eye can see, the trees killed by salt water. The Dardars blame the old canals like this one intersecting their bayou for allowing the ocean water in. All this moving water also makes the shoreline erode faster.
It pretty much washes away that bottom and then eventually works its way up until it all falls into the water.
The oil and gas companies were supposed to fill the canals back in with soil, but the state stopped enforcing the requirement long ago. So the Dardars and their partners secured over $550,000 in grants to start doing it themselves. They hope this canal will be the first. Research from Louisiana State University shows filling the canals back in repairs the land and is relatively inexpensive.
You got a mussel on there, two mussels, three mussels, four mussels.
Donald is leading another restoration project to protect the shoreline here. He and a team from the Coalition to Restore Coastal Louisiana stack bags of oyster shells collected from local restaurants along the banks. Over time, the barrier builds up as new oysters and mussels grow on top of the old shells.
The goal of this is for this to just keep growing and expanding. Hopefully they go bust through these bags and just keep growing.
Since 2019, they've built two 400-foot reefs from about 400 tons of oyster shells. During that time, the bank that isn't protected has eroded by several feet.
Since we didn't go no further with the bags, then right here, it eroded.
For the Dardars to have any hope of saving their land, these projects need to be done at a much larger scale. Louisiana is already spending billions on its coastal master plan, an almost two-decade-long effort to battle the rising seas. But the Dardars feel left out.
So we have to go on our own looking for funds to try to save our community because they're not.
The Dardars are fighting with another tribal leader, Rosina Philippe, to get more funding for resiliency projects and storm repairs. For years, Philippe was president of the First Peoples Conservation Council, which advocates for tribes along Louisiana's coast. She's also a tribal elder in Grand Bayou Village, 40 miles east of the Dardars. It's a tiny indigenous community only accessible by boat.
We've been inhabitants of Louisiana for many, many centuries. Our whole lives tied around being on the coast and, you know, connection to the water.
Damage from Hurricane Ida in 2021 is obvious everywhere.
That dock is washed away and it needs to be replaced.
Homes are destroyed and boats, lifelines for the community, wrecked.
I'm borrowing this boat today because my boat is still damaged from Ida.
Philippe's brother, Maurice, earns a living from fishing. He also gives away hundreds, sometimes thousands of pounds of seafood each year to help feed his community. But Hurricane Ida caused $25,000 worth of damage to his boat.
I've been having boats all my life, and this is supposed to be my last one, hopefully. And seeing it the way it is right now, it's heartbreaking.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, could help out. Last year, it handed out more than $3 billion to victims of disasters. But the National Congress of American Indians says federal money for security and emergencies isn't delivered evenly. Tribal citizens receive only $3 for every $26 that non-tribal citizens receive from the Department of Homeland Security, which houses FEMA.
The government is paper heavy. Paper, it's not an indigenous concept. It's not how we record time or events.
Tribe members often don't have documents like land deeds and home records that the government requires. On top of it, many don't have basic computer skills, but the applications are all online. So Philippe has helped create a program to train tribal members to navigate these complex government systems.
We're trying to find a way to make the connection between who we are and what they expect.
Recently, a small victory. After lobbying from Philippe and others, the Biden administration extended the deadline for Hurricane Ida relief in Louisiana to June 1st. Philippe says the hard work is worth it because despite the challenges, her people will never leave.
We have outsiders come here and they see the lack and they see the loss. We who belong here, we see what's still here, what's still viable. What still makes life in this region, you know, so precious. We don't just survive here, we thrive.
For PBS News Weekend, I'm Megan Thompson in Grand Bayou Village, Louisiana.
Now online, more reporting on the environment, including an Instagram story on what it will take to reduce global plastic pollution. All that and more on our news on our webpage. NewsHour Instagram page. And that is PBS News Weekend for this Saturday. I'm John Yang. For all of my colleagues, thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow.